Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And joining me today, once again, is James Roguski. James is a writer, a researcher, and I would say also an investigative journalist who, to the best of my knowledge, broke the story regarding the U.S.'s proposed amendments to the World Health Organization's international health regulations, which were voted on recently, still somewhat up in the air with regard to the outcome of that vote, although there was heavy pushback, particularly from a constituency of African countries. So the World Health Organization didn't get anywhere near everything it wanted to get, but there are still some open doors that it could sneak some one world policies through. Currently, James is focused on that, but he's also focused on an equally disturbing development that is set to go down next week. Actually, a series of developments with regard to the FDA and its approval of COVID-19 injections. They call them vaccines. These are toxic injections, nowhere near vaccines, for children in particular. This is something that we know the companies, Pfizer, Moderna, in this case, have been aiming for quite some time, and there are various reasons for that. But this is really coming down to the wire now. They are going for the children, and it's so many things, criminal in particular. But without further ado, let me bring James on, and we can get into this. James, welcome back to Perspective. Thank you for taking the time to join me today.
Oh, well, thank you for giving me the time and the opportunity. I will dive right in. I guess sure. We've got two topics and we've got almost an hour. So, you know, maybe we'll do 20 minutes on each or so.
Sure.
To recap what happened with the WHO, for any of the listeners who are just learning about this now, back in January, the Biden administration presented some amendments to the WHO, and these would be amendments to international health regulations. And for the last 2 months or so, I've been trying to keep everyone's head clear. And I would start off by saying, hey, everybody, I'm talking about these proposed amendments to the international health regulations. If you hear anyone say the word treaty or pandemic treaty, that's not what I had been talking about in April and May. That I would then say, if you want to talk about the pandemic treaty, let's talk about that in June. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so here we are in June. And so now the discussion has shifted to talks of a treaty, a proposed treaty, pandemic treaty. So let me wrap up what we were talking about in April and May. And so essentially what happened in the last week of May was the World Health Assembly met in Geneva. That's where 194 nations send their delegates, and 250 non-government organizations, non-state actors, foundations, nonprofits send their delegates as well. People often forget about that. There's many more non-state actors than there are nations. And the summary of what happened, in my opinion, my analysis of it, is the Biden administration's proposals were left standing at the altar. They were, you know, maybe invited to the prom and they got stood up. They got kicked to the curb. They got spanked. Okay. Hmm. The document that the Biden administration submitted and proposed back in January was not ever brought to a vote. It was just completely wiped out. What did happen was a totally separate document was submitted, I believe, illegitimately. The rules of the road are there's a 4-month advance warning in Article 55 of the International Health Regulations that says, well, if somebody wants to propose amendments, they have to do so 4 months before the assembly. Well, mm-hmm. somehow, some way, very, very entertainingly for me, the document that was submitted on Tuesday, the 24th of May, included a couple of minor changes to the very article, Article 55, that states that any amendments have to be proposed 4 months in advance. So it's a self-defeating document where it actually includes the article that says you can't do this, right? But right. they did it anyway.
That particular clause wasn't changed about the 4 months, right?
They changed a couple of little words in involving a few things. It was an inconsequential change, but it was just entertaining to me that on page 3, Article 55, Section 2, was in the document that they submitted during the assembly. It says in the document that you can't do that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess that's their sixth sense of humor. And so anyways, that document was what was considered through the assembly. There were at least 50 nations that, you know, wanted to speak about it. And I summarized all of that on my Substack article, which is jamesverkusky.substack.com. It's entitled We Won, because that document triggered a lot of discussion in back rooms. It was very clear that they were not having those discussions on the floor of the meeting of the committee. They clearly said, well, we're going to be meeting in, you know, this room somewhere, and we'll let you know what we decide in the back room. And mm-hmm. on Friday, the 27th, an amended version of this second batch of amendments was made available Monday morning. And ultimately, they vote, but the type of voting that they do is not a roll call vote where each country says yay or nay. It's they work out all of the disagreement in a hidden back room somewhere, and then mm-hmm. they know everybody's on board because they've made whatever deals they've made, they bring it up for consideration, and they'll say, you know, in regards to this document, are there any objections? And they'll wait 5 or 10 seconds, and nobody jumps up and down and objects. And, you know, kind of like at a wedding, you know, speak now or forever hold your peace.
Right.
And so the second document was adopted by unanimous consent because nobody objected. So that's a form of voting. It's not the type of voting that, you know, most people think of. But, you know, if you don't object, then you agree to it by your silence. And so they mm-hmm. did adopt, it was actually amendments to 5 different articles of the International Health Regulations, completely different set of things than what Biden had proposed. And it's been amazing to watch the mainstream media and the alternative media and just media across the board absolutely mangle the facts of what happened. Mm-hmm. And so it actually ended up being a complete victory with a cherry on top that even I didn't see coming. This document that was adopted, these amendments to 5 different articles of the International Health Regulations, actually scraped back some additional sovereignty from the WHO to the individual countries. And it was in regards to if there ever is an amendment in a future assembly, the nations now have something they did not have before, which is similar, not identical, but similar to a line item veto. Every nation under Article 61 can just flat out reject an amendment in the future. I mean, they've always been mm-hmm. able to do that. They just have to write a letter to the WHO within 10 months and just reject it. But now they actually have the additional ability to nitpick it. You know, they might say, well, we don't like this paragraph. We don't like this sentence. We don't like this phrase. And they can propose what they call a reservation. They have a reservation mm-hmm. about a certain aspect of an amendment in the future. And so, you know, that's a net gain. That was a cherry on top of a complete and total victory. And sure. They also adopted an internal document that's not legally binding to anybody but the WHO. The 47 African nations and a bunch of other countries were, I believe, very unhappy that the attempts to make these changes were so hidden and, you know, not open to public scrutiny, that they passed a document number 17, which set up a working group for the International Health Regulations, WGIHR. And this is an internal WHO bureau, literally. They created a little bit more bureaucracy. They created a bureau, and that's what they do, okay? And that working group is supposed to meet sometime in November, before November 15th. All nations can submit proposed amendments to the IHR by September 30th, and they'll meet in November to discuss those in a relatively more open way, to present them to the World Health Organization by January, which would be 4 months in advance of next May. And so, you know, it's I don't want to say it's on the back burner, it's on the future burner, okay? The amendments that were proposed by the Biden administration went down to an absolutely stunning defeat with a cherry on top. And at some point in the future, you know, some nations may attempt to make changes, but now there's a standardized procedure by which that is going to happen. So, I mean, you know, that's just an enormous win. And, you know, it's partly a testament to the African nations who, I'm guessing, you know, with a lot of public push, because we did communicate, you know, with many people in Africa, they just said, you know, we probably ought to read these things before we agree to them. Okay. And right. So when they read them, the phrase that was put around was, well, they were having difficulty reaching consensus. And in my interpretation, my translation, you know, that's fancy diplomatic talk for somebody said, what in the hell do you think you're doing? Okay.
Right.
And so it you know, is a wonderful victory for we the people and for national sovereignty. And, you know, the WHO clearly lost in their attempt to reset how emergencies were declared. And, you know, it's interesting how the media, both mainstream and alternative, have just absolutely botched the story. There's a saying, I don't know who it's attributed to, but it's an old saying where a person said, you know, everything you read in the paper is absolutely true, except anything that you actually had personal experience with. And so for me, being so deep down this rabbit hole, being in such command of the details, it's just amazing. Not surprising, but still amazing at how what the media has presented to the public is just so damn wrong, you know? And so thanks for having me on. For, you know, there've been a few who've gotten it correct, but, you know, thanks for having me on just to, you know, enable me to share the information with people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate your clarification, because I'll admit that until just now, I was, I thought I understood what was decided, but it turns out to be quite a bit different. And as you said, a bit more complex than I had figured. But how is this being interpreted wrongly in other media? What are they saying?
All throughout, there was a confusion where there are millions of words that have been written about something loosely referred to as a proposed pandemic treaty. And so for 2 months, I had been saying, if anybody says the word treaty, that's not what I'm talking about. Okay. Mm-hmm. But still, in the weeks running up to the World Health Assembly, everybody was talking about a treaty. And in the week of the assembly, people were talking about the pandemic treaty. And after this all happened, there have been countless reports of, oh, the pandemic treaty has been defeated. And it's like, hey, folks, they're just now getting started on the pandemic treaty. Wow. You know, I've been trying to clarify this for 2 months, and you still don't understand that what happened on June 1st was the WHO and their intergovernmental negotiating body, the INB, quietly on page 2 in a footnote of a document that they posted quietly up on their page, said, oh, yeah, by the way, you know that public comment period that we had scheduled for June 16th and June 17th? They canceled that. And they canceled that claiming that they're all for transparency and inclusivity. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how they can use language that is exactly the opposite of what they're doing. Okay. Yes. So we had been getting ready to be gearing up to have people do a public comment, both spoken, you know, over Zoom, you know, audio video mm-hmm. presentation, which I got to do back in April. So I understand, you know, the process that they were talking about. We did this back in April, talking about the pandemic treaty. And in 5 days, we managed to get 36,000 people to put in written public comments. Excellent. I got to speak. A handful of other folks from around the world got to speak, and so now we're considered to be interested stakeholders, right? Hmm. And so I got an email in the middle of the morning, just this morning, that they were going to be having a live stream at 5 a.m. Okay, so I get an email at like 1 a.m. saying that they were going to have a live stream at 5 a.m. You know, obviously it's in Geneva, so the time difference. But hey, guys, you know, thanks for the warning. And right. the 20 minute live stream that they did was just absolutely obnoxious. I mean, just I don't even want to talk about it. It was just so disgusting in how they are claiming to want to, you know, have transparency and inclusivity when, you know, next week on the 16th and the 17th, they were supposed to have a public comment period, you know, audio, visual, and spoke and written rather. And, you know, they just flat out canceled it. And the reason that they gave goes back to the 36,000 comments that came from April. They literally stated on June 1st, they did publish the fact that they recognized that we had 36,000 comments. And they stated that the majority of the comments essentially said, because the question was, you know, what do we feel should be in the proposed pandemic treaty? And the majority of comments said there shouldn't be a pandemic treaty.
Exactly.
And so when they canceled the upcoming public comment period, the reason they gave was that they wanted to ensure that all of the input would be in support of their efforts. And it's like, you know, their solution to our saying we don't want a treaty is for them to say, well, we don't want any comments. Okay. And, you know, it's a mockery. They're making a mockery of any hint of, you know, pretending to be democratic and wanting to listen to the will of the people. They have an open door for what they call civil society. Mm-hmm. They call them interested stakeholders. they, you know, their foundations. And it's really the third leg of modern fascism. Mussolini defined fascism as the combination of government and corporate power. But there's a new game in town, and the third leg of modern authoritarian fascism are foundations, non-state actors, non-government organizations, charities, you know, nonprofit 501(c) corporations. They present themselves as being benevolent civil society. And so governments throw money, you know, at Planned Parenthood and the Red Cross and, you know, foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Gavi and all these different groups. And then they contract with corporations to, you know, stick needles in arms of people to give them, you know, injections, all pretending to be improving the health of the world while everyone just keeps getting sicker and sicker and poorer and poorer. But the money flows dramatically from foundations to corporations, and the people, you know, it's a revolving door. They get a government job, they get a foundation job, they get a corporate job, and, you know, everybody at that level has multiple conflicts of interest. But that's, you know, that's now known in good 1984 newspeak, where you change the meaning of words. All of that corruption is comes under the phrase public-private partnership. So if you hear the phrase public-private partnership, you're about to get screwed.
Yeah. One of my regular guests, Ian Davis, who's an excellent journalist and researcher from the UK, he refers to it as the global public-private partnership. And he put together this excellent chart, which shows the top-down hierarchy. At the top, you have the international banking cartel. Just beneath that, you have the policy designers, so to speak. So you have the WHO, you have the World Economic Forum, you have the Council on Foreign Relations, you have Chatham House, Club of Rome, and they make policy, they develop policy and disseminate it downward to nation state governments who enforce the policy. They do that in large part by using the corporate media, and then we plebs are at the bottom, and it's our duty to swallow and follow that policy as dictated to us. But you're absolutely right. This is a fusion of corporations, of NGOs, of stakeholders from various sectors. And, you know, this is the language and the architecture of what Klaus Schwab refers to as the fourth industrial revolution. You know, this is it in action, and it bodes well for nobody's autonomy, either individually or collectively. So that said, we have to throw it to a quick break. But when we get back, I want to ask you one more question about what just went down in Geneva. And then we must get into what's going to happen next week, because it's very urgent. So everybody hang tight, and I'll be back with James Roguski after this.
Shannon Joy on TNT Radio.
The gentleman who saved hundreds of children, hundreds of lives in Uvalde, Texas, had a unique opportunity. He had a unique skill set. And rather than standing around like the dozens and dozens of government agents, he did something. He was courageous. He went in. I could never do that. Most of you could never do that. Some of you could. What is it that you can do? Whether you're listening to me in London or in Australia, New Zealand, humanity is the same. This all works the same way. They want to remove us from our communities. They want to erase human connections. They want us tethered to machines. Our job is to resist that and get off of the screens, get into our communities, meet people face to face. Again, money, 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 power, power, power.
Shannon Joy on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Interview conducted at 10:15, present are Sergeant Jones, PC Clough, Mr. Wall, an uninsulated cavity wall, and his solicitor, Mr. Bent. Do you understand the charges?
I shall be speaking for Mr. Wall on account of him being a pile of bricks.
Right, you're accused of wasting energy, Mr. Wall, and we've got concrete evidence. We know that unfilled cavity walls are responsible for up to a third of all home energy wastage.
We also believe you're involved in a fencing operation.
We're going to throw the book at you.
Okay. Mr. Wall would like to say, ouch.
It's criminal to waste energy. To find out how to save up to 25% off your heating bills, visit saveenergy.co.uk or call 0845 727 7200.
Join the pink frilly tutus.
Join the walkers, the joggers, the runners.
Join the people remembering friends, family, loved ones.
Join the kids, the mothers, the grannies.
Join those who are living with cancer.
Join those who have beaten it.
Join the most fantastic day.
Join the 5 and 10K events making a difference in the fight to beat cancer.
Join the girls this summer at Tesco and Cancer Research UK's Race for Life. Join now. Find an event near you at raceforlife.org.
This is where you get your daily ration of high-velocity conversation. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio. I am Jesse Zerwell, and I am speaking with journalist and researcher and writer. And I say journalist purposely because, James, I think you've been doing some excellent investigative journalist work. James Roguski is who I'm speaking to. And James, just before we get into what's going on next week with the FDA, I want to ask you quickly about the World Health Organization's One Health high-level expert panel. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but according to their page on the World Health Organization's website, One Health stands for an integrative and systemic approach to health, grounded on the understanding that human health is closely linked to the healthiness of food, animals, and the environment, and the healthy balance of their impact on the ecosystems they share everywhere in the world. And their focus is in particular on zoonosis-driven pandemics, and they have members from around the world, from China and from Russia. This seems to be another intergovernmental body that could possibly circumvent the victory that we just talked about. And what stood out to me when I watched some of the country delegates making remarks in Geneva is that Russia's delegate, who also happens to be a member of this One Health high-level expert panel, stated in his remarks that Russia is very enthusiastic about and very much on board with this high-level expert panel, which also includes China's Fauci, so to speak, a similar figure who is responsible for, who has been responsible for much of the horrific responses to so-called COVID-19 that we've seen in China. So I just wanted to get your comment on this, if you're aware of it, and what you think it might bode for the future.
No fair asking me a question that would need a 10-hour show to answer.
Okay, okay. Fair enough.
But I'll try to really distill it down and give you some 200 proof information. Obviously, One Health is in keeping with one interpretation of the WHO's constitution. Their constitution lists, you know, what the charter basically is of the World Health Organization, which is to view the health of the world, okay? And I'll try to make a joke of it, and then I'll try to be serious. I've worked with some folks in Malaysia, and we've been talking about this thing that's going around that I refer to as moneypox. Okay, the K is silent, people. It's moneypox that's going around. And one of the things that we noticed is that the nations where moneypox has been popping up, the UK, Spain, Portugal, wherever else this may be looked at as a problem, are actually places where they've had high vaccination rates, and they don't have very many monkeys. Okay, And so, you know, I'm talking to people in Malaysia and you know, Brazil, and you know, there's a lot of beautiful, wonderful monkeys in the jungles around the world, you know, Africa and so forth. Not too many monkeys in Canada and the UK and Spain and Portugal. And so the stretch of going from, you know, zoonotic transfer, where, you know, wild animals come into contact with domesticated animals and they transfer some kind of pathogen. And then those domesticated animals come into contact with, you know, human beings. And so we catch it from, you know, dogs and cats and cows and pigs and chickens. It's a front. It's propaganda. You know, I'm deeply interested in agricultural practices, farming practices. You know, I've got a much neglected food forest in my yard here in, you know, what is essentially Los Angeles. Mother Nature is doing her job. And, you know, I had a wonderful harvest of apricots this year, and I forgot all about them because I've been so busy doing what I'm doing. You know, Mother Nature is running the show out in my yard these days. Okay. and so, obviously agricultural practices and animal husbandry and, you know, the connection between Mother Earth and animals and plants and the environment is an important concept. But they're not talking about the types of things that I'm concerned about. And a lot of people who are, you know, looking towards a better, healthy relationship with food and all that sort of stuff, their interpretation of One Health is that one group be given all of the authority over the entire planet, where obviously from a health perspective with pathogens, whether it be COVID or moneypox or any of these sort of things, I encourage people to go to jamesrakuski.substack.com and read my article on moneypox. Okay. You know, that's the next best pandemic prospect. All right. And oh, it is absolutely not what you think it is, folks. And so they're trying to hide the fact that they failed miserably these past 2 years because they wanted to have a one-size-fits-all answer where really the best results were, you know, with people like the FLCCC or the frontline doctors or doctors like Shankara Chetty in South Africa or other doctors,
amazing doctor.
In California, where, you know, the unique solutions to personal health issues, you have all of these different solutions on a local level where knowledge and information and ideas are not stifled. Creative practitioners pay attention to their individual patients and they treat them appropriately, not in a uniform manner dictated by some bureaucrat in Geneva. And so, you know, if you want to be treated like a farm animal and herded to slaughter by being given the same treatment, the same injection, the same protocol that clearly was so abundantly wrong, right? Then you might want to have and support this One Health idea, because One Health, there's not one answer to everyone's health. There's the freedom to make individual choices, the freedom to make mistakes and learn from them, as opposed to this autocratic, top-down fascist control through the what I call the medical, hospital, pharmaceutical, media, industrial complex. They know better, and they will tell everybody what to do, and everyone should just obey. Boy, I don't really think that's a good idea.
No, I don't either. So I would just recommend that everybody go to who.int/groups/onehealth-high-level-expert-panel. And there are hyphens between each word in One Health High Level Expert Panel. You can look up the members of this panel. As I said, they include George Fu Gao, who's the Director General of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and prevention. If you're wondering where the lockdown protocol came from, if you're wondering where the intubation protocol came from, it came from this gentleman specifically. And there are countries all around the world, including Russia, who are on board with this One Health entity. And it's something I think that we definitely need to keep an eye on going into the future with all of this bureaucracy and technocracy. But that said, thank you for your answer on that, James. As you said, it's a conversation unto itself. But I want to get into now what's happening next week, which is very much targeting children here in the U.S. and sets a precedent for the world, I think. And this, you know, to me is nothing short of child sacrifice. It's homicidal. But what is set to go on next week, and then what is going on June 28th as well with regard to the FDA?
On Wednesday, June 15th, there's a doubleheader. There is a vaccine advisory committee meeting that will be discussing both Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech's injectable products to be considered for authorized use under, you know, emergency use in infants as young as 6 months of age. And child sacrifice is as good a description as any, because I'll try to talk about a lot of the details, but the details in this particular case, I think, only serve to distract people's attention from just one really simple detail. Children of that age do not die from COVID.
Right.
And, you know, I'll repeat it five times if you let me. You know, children of that age do not die from COVID. So any risk benefit analysis, the benefit is zero. So, you know, it's a mathematical thing with fractions. When you divide by zero, the number is infinite. It doesn't matter what the risk is. And so any single individual child who is harmed by an injection, okay, that means that the risk benefit ratio is infinite, because there can be no benefit. Mm-hmm. And so when a whole lot of words get thrown around at this meeting that is going to be live streamed, and, you know, I'm putting it out there for everybody. Save the date. You know, it's like an invitation to a wedding or something. Next Wednesday, all day long, they're going to be live streaming both Moderna and Pfizer discussions. Moderna has leaked some information that originally the numbers were even lower, but I think they've been trying to tweak them, and they got it to where the rumor, anyways, is that they say that the Moderna vaccination or injection is 51% effective in 6 months to 2-year-old children. And it's only 37% effective from 2 to 6. Well, you know, what is...
And it has to be over 50% in order to qualify for emergency use authorization, correct?
That has been sort of, you know, a seat of the pants guideline, okay? And rules mm-hmm. are obviously made to be broken, as we've discussed already. But more to the point, here's something that I'm going to bet your listeners, once I mention it, it'll be obvious, but it's not something that people think about on a regular basis, all right? I've paid a lot of attention to the data coming out of Israel and the data coming out of England specifically. And the data out of England has been, for a data geek like me, it's been entertaining, if not insane, okay? They mm-hmm. originally were talking about how the Pfizer vaccine was 95% effective, right? Well, that never involved considering death from COVID. That was never, ever part of the definition of the word effective, okay? It was just whether or not you get a positive COVID test. Okay, which is completely manipulatable by, you know, how you set the test. Be that as it may, they started talking back, you know, 2 years ago almost, that it was 95% effective. And then it was 80, and then it was 70, and then they stopped talking about the number, because I'm here to let everybody know that the terminology of whether or not something is effective can be positive, but it can also be negative. You can have something that has a negative effectiveness. And once this thing started nosediving into, you know, headed towards negative effectiveness, they stop talking about the number and they just say that it's effective. Well, I'm here to tell you that what they mean is that it's got a negative 400% rating, which means people in England who've been triple jabbed are four times as likely to get COVID as people who were never jabbed. Now, that's not
read another way, these injections are destroying people's immune systems.
And the same data implies that by the metrics that they're using, when it started, you inject anything into somebody, their immune system is going to be alerted and be more active. And so you could inject almost anything into somebody and you'll trigger an immune response. And if you measure that response, you'll say, wow, you know, that's, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80% above baseline. Okay. And then you inject it again and you inject it again and you inject it again. And the body is like, oh, wait a minute. You know, what the heck is going on? Certain cells are removed. Other cells are increased. And what's really made to happen is the immune system is put way out of balance and aspects of it, quite frankly, get fatigued. Okay. And so the latest data out of England is that people are operating at about 20% capacity, right? In the thing that they were measuring that was being stimulated and boosted, right? Thus the term booster. You know, I actually got to get out of, I got to get out of thesaurus and get out a good antonym for boost, okay? Because the boosters are working in a negative fashion. And so I guess you could call them anti-boosters, right? It's everyone's immune system in England is averaging about 20% of normal. And so that doesn't mean you're going to die. It just means your immune system is 80% less likely to keep you from dying. And that's what they're seeing. And so given that information, coming back, because I know we only got maybe 10 minutes or so,
We actually have to throw it to one more quick break. So if you're okay, we can do that right now and then come back and continue this. So everybody, once again, hang tight and I'll be right back with James Roguski after this.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
US news website Axios launched an interactive dashboard last week of Google Trends data showing which topics are driving searches in each congressional district and how they compare with the rest of the United States. Many political operatives will be looking to this dashboard in an attempt to gain political advantage in targeted messages for the November midterm elections. Search interest data across numerous political issues is collected on a weekly basis for 24,809 cities spread across the United States, and specific data for each of the 435 congressional districts is available online. On average, the most searched topics are for jobs, taxes, firearms, Ukraine, and wages. Political propagandists will use this data, but it doesn't tell us what Americans actually think about the respective topics, and no political spin will change reality. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
You have the right to know. The right to know about culture. The right to know about the economy. The right to know about technology and to know about sports. You have the right to know about education and politics and the weather. You have the right to know what's happening abroad and in your backyard. But above all else, you have the right to know that this right is under attack, and we must work to protect it. Because in order to be free, we must be informed. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads?
Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, "The difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course this has a big impact on your identity."
During the pandemic, 129 billion unrecyclable masks were used and thrown away every month. Over 3 billion masks now pollute the oceans. Let's not turn a blind eye to this disgusting plastic pollution. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, your host for the rest of the hour, and I am speaking with James Roguski. And we're talking about what's coming up next week with regard to the FDA making a decision on Pfizer, BioNTech's, and Moderna's injections for children in the age range of 6 months to 5 years for Moderna and 6 months to 4 years for Pfizer, BioNTech. In addition to that, on June 14th, the committee, and this is the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, also known as VRBPAC, they are meeting to discuss whether or not there should be emergency use approval of the Moderna injection for children and adolescents 6 years through 17 years of age. So in a matter of 2 days, they're going to try to essentially ram through EUAs for these toxic injections for kids from 6 months up to 17 years of age. And it should be noted that this VRBPAC entity, when it came to removing the EUA for remdesivir so that it could be used for children as young as 28 weeks, I believe, or 28 days, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to double check on that. They didn't even meet, this committee didn't even meet to remove that EUA so that it could be used on babies, essentially remdesivir, a highly toxic drug that's being touted as a treatment for SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. And then on top of that, James, on June 28th, they're going to be considering what Dr. Toby Rogers has pointed out as the future framework for injections. So we know they're coming for the kids next week. What is this future framework all about?
Yes, Toby's done some great work on his Substack. I think people should follow. I think it's Utobian, U-T-O-B-I-A-N, I believe is his .substack.com. Yep. Is his work.
It's TobyRogers.substack.com.
Okay. So the idea is that they don't want to have to go through any kind of testing. They know they have a delivery mechanism, and they just want to be able to switch out the innards, if you will, put in a new genetic sequence and not have to go through the process of actually testing it. The absurdity is astounding. And so coming back full circle to try to wrap this all up, the idea from my perspective is you're certainly not going to get accurate, honest information from the mainstream media. I've been much disappointed with many of the alternative media who oftentimes mm-hmm. seem to just follow the lead of the mainstream media and report on what the mainstream media is doing and maybe give a little bit of an alternative view, but it actually only serves to feed the narrative. I mean, if you're running right. clips of what they said on the mainstream and you're not actually just talking about the alternative viewpoint, are you part of the propaganda? You know, because a lot of it is just repetition if you hear something over and over and over again. And so, right. In addition to being an investigative researcher, and there isn't really a word for what I do, which is just try to take this complicated stuff and translate it into English that people can you know, wrap their head around. I guess translating medical jargon and legal jargon and, you know, just all this other stuff into common everyday English that people can get their head around. I'm also an activist and an organizer. And so part of it is, you know, how do you present something that people can take action on? And so, you know, coming forward, Monday, the 13th, is the deadline for people to put in their public comment to the FDA in regards to possible authorization of Moderna and Pfizer for babies. Okay. And so on my Substack, I have a domain that points directly to the pertinent article, and that is opposethefraud.com. Because this is clearly going to be a fraud that is about to be perpetrated on not just the United States, but all of humanity. The FDA has stated that 2 days from today, I guess Friday, they like to do these things on Friday, they will finally be presenting the documents that are going to be discussed next Wednesday. And so I would like to put a shout out to all of your listeners. Please feel free to call me directly at 310-619-3055. If you're from another country, you can use Signal or Telegram or WhatsApp or text me at 310-619-3055. The country code, I believe, is +1 for the United States, because we're going to get a data dump of documents on Friday regarding the Moderna and the Pfizer studies on, you know, young children. And they're going to do their best to present that information, that data, and make it seem like their products are a necessity for little babies.
Right. And even though they failed all of their trials.
Well, here's the interesting twist, which is where I started, okay? There cannot possibly be any health benefit because babies from 6 months to 4 or 5 don't die from COVID.
Right. Okay? I'm just working from within their framework, not that I accept it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so part of it is to you know, I'm the kind of person, and I hope many of your listeners are the type of people who want to dig in and understand, you know, the data. And that's a valid quest. And I hope people will help with that and, you know, comment and send me their comments, information, you know, work together collaboratively on that. I look forward to that. But also, I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that there cannot be any benefit for children's health. This is a ruse. Because what they really want to have is they want to get these injections to be a universal platform that they can get onto the childhood schedule, and they can keep switching out the DNA, I'm sorry, the RNA, mRNA in these platforms, and just keep doing all kinds of experiments on children and adults. If they get it on the childhood schedule, there's a belief that they then can maintain their liability protection even if the public health emergency is lifted. And so the purpose of this, it is logical, it is reasonable, but it is evil because you have to look at the purpose from the point of view of the pharmaceutical companies. From their point of view, this makes all the sense in the world. From a mom and dad and grandma and uncle and aunt standpoint, you know, where they're going to now try to coerce people into injecting babies so that they can go to daycare. Because, you know, the next thing that's going to be coming is, you know, maybe not mandates, but, you know, coercive rules from companies that take care of babies while mom and dad go to work. And so if all of a sudden your baby doesn't have an injection and the caretaker, you know, the corporation, the company that provides the daycare kicks the non-vaccinated children to the curb, mom and dad aren't going to, you know, they're going to be in a world of hurt to try to make ends meet, because many people rely on having their babies taken care of while they work to make a living. And so that's what's coming, people. So speak now or forever hold your peace, because, you know, I think this is a unifying issue. If whatever your political party, your race, your religion, you know, any other idea that you may have that we may disagree on, this is a unifying idea that I trust we're all going to come together on to protect the children. We have to.
Yes. Yes, we absolutely have to. And just to end on cue, Wall Street Journal published today an article, Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine, which I would put in inverted commas, targeting Omicron produces stronger immune response. And this is a modified version of their current injection that they're hoping to put through this future framework without having to go through any sort of regulation. Never mind the fact that these injections not only do not work in children, they don't work in anybody. They are lethal, clinically worthless serums. James, unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much for your time today, and I hope we can speak again soon.
Anytime. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.